Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome to our first show of 2017. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
My name's Darren Bresnitz.
It is. We are joined by Michael Whiteman for, I think it's our seventh time together.
It is.
For our annual trend show. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes.
I'm glad to be here. It's fun.
We have enjoyed reading your trend report, and we look back at last year, and it seems to be that this year is really evolving on a lot of the issues that you touched on last year. And where we wanted to start it was the Uberization and Amazonization of food. And kind of how it's becoming much more of a service and utility that adapts to the customer as opposed to going out to eat.
Sure. When we last left this subject, which was a year ago, we were talking about the fact that big companies like Uber and Amazon and smaller companies like Postmates and Grubhub and 10 other names that are probably familiar to you, have all facilitated the entire country becoming one big couch potato because people have discovered that they can very easily order meals of restaurant quality and have them delivered right to their couch.
But what seems interesting is that while it was technology companies that got into it, it seems like the chefs have caught up, which I thought was one of the bigger developments and what's coming in the next year.
That's correct. Not only chefs, but small startups that are focusing on restaurant quality food. What fascinates us is a term that we've put into our trends list called restaurants without seats. And that is going to change the way people eat in the year ahead and probably for the rest of the decade. And when I say restaurants without seats, I'm referring to people who are opening in offbeat locations where rent is cheap, kitchens with no front of the house, but staffed with cooks and chefs whose sole purpose is to deliver food to your living room or to your dining room. And they are now in locations where they don't have to worry about paying for linens or for tableware or broken glasses or waiters or flowers or any of that stuff, because there is no front of the house and they don't want you ever to find them. They're not interested in that. They're only interested in your email address and your and your physical address.
There were a couple of good stories in 2016 of people trying to find these restaurants and realizing that it was a sham.
There's actually there's a company in New York that has eight, we call them phantom restaurants. They've got eight phantom restaurants. They're web only. They're delivery only. There is no location. The eight restaurants serve eight different menu concepts out of two different kitchens, and they serve the entire city. And go find them. Good luck. There's no address.
Another thing that's also coming from this is that the chefs are coming from a really strong food service point of view. I think when you could get something from Uber or Postmates, it was delivery. They would bring you food and that was it. But you can even see from David Chang and Ando, they actually are only cooking food that works well for delivery or developing types of packaging or making sure that there's ways that the food can travel and be really good when you get it, as opposed to just showing up and you hope it's not overcooked or doesn't continue, or cooks on the back of the bike as they're delivering it.
It's a very clever development. And you're right about cooks like and chefs like David Chang and others who are not merely just facilitating the movement of food from point A to point B, but are creating food specifically so that it can travel well, so that you're not plagued at the end of the day by a soggy burrito.
And oddly enough, the Philly cheesesteak is something that travels really, really well.
It does. And by the way, you know, the country itself has been willing to compromise for decades now about the quality of food that is delivered to your homes. Think, for example, immediately of pizza. I mean, it's never a really good pizza.
Yeah, or noodles for that matter, unless it's like you just expect that they're soggy or they're overcooked or they're kind of mushy. And I think that this is where Amazon and Uber and Postmates are going to have to actually step up their game, because people will begin to differentiate and buy for the quality of these high-level chefs now getting into something that has much better margins, much better speed, and delivers the quality people are used to.
I think that the place to really look is the big companies. Because they're investing lots and lots of money, not just in the, as you said, the technology of moving food around, but they're moving into creating their own food, their own brands, and making them specifically for travel. I can give you the beginnings of an example. Amazon has opened just last month a store that's full of prepared foods, packaged foods, with no cashiers.
Amazon Go store.
Yeah, you walk in with your smartphone, and it knows what you've put into your bag. If you take something out of your bag because you decide you didn't want it and put it back on the shelf, it subtracts it, and you just leave. The bill will appear on your smartphone.
Do you see a larger shift than in the actual supply chain of the ingredients, like the food itself? Like, do you see them having more control in the way that McDonald's, Burger King used to have control with that? Like, do you see, like, you know, more natural food, less pesticides, more things like that? Or are they just trying to do large-scale agriculture cheap just so they can compete in the delivery service?
Let me answer a slightly different question, and then we can come back to that. I think the companies that you mentioned, like McDonald's or Burger King, or even the casual chains like Chili's and Red Lobster, are becoming captive of the service companies around them. And by that I mean, you make your reservation on OpenTable. That's a service. You order your food to go on your Apple phone. That's a service, or Google, and that's a service. Postmates or Grubhub picks it up and takes it to your house, and that's a service. So, what's left for the restaurants is the dirty work of creating, preparing, and packaging the food, and paying commissions to all these other people who are bringing customers to you. It's a very interesting change in how people shop.
And the other thing that Darren and I were debating earlier is people turning their kitchens into businesses and actually cooking for you and being able to order that. We couldn't figure out. And you said couch potato. I thought it was cool. Darren thinks it's lazy. So I think we're kind of split with the necessary tiebreaker.
Hold on. I don't think it's lazy. I just, the idea of having someone two doors down from you and you say, cook me some food, then bring it over to my house and I'm going to pay you. I think it's not so much lazy. It's just, I just never even thought of that being a possibility.
Well, you're both partially wrong.
Okay.
I couldn't resist that. There is a movement, and it's not a giant one, but it's growing, and it's important. And it's quite the opposite of what I said before. We were talking just a moment ago about restaurants without seats. Now we're talking about seats without restaurants. Companies like Airbnb, just to take a big and familiar example, are now working on end-to-end travel arrangements. So if I happen to be traveling to London and I've put myself up an Airbnb host somewhere in London, Airbnb will also connect me with somebody in London who's registered with Airbnb, who happens to run a dining room like a boarding house. And a bunch of strangers will show up who've made reservations, paid in advance on their smartphones, and are eating home-cooked food rather than going out to a restaurant. Or if I'm in Portugal And I really don't know where to eat, but I want somebody to show me what home cooking is like. There are websites that will connect me to somebody who has a kitchen that's used to cooking for a lot of people, and I will go to somebody's house. And again, it's like a potluck dinner. And these things are cropping up all around the world. A very interesting way to experience a new form of consumer economy.
But is this in many? I'm sorry. Go on. I was going to say, is this in many ways getting back to one authenticity in a dining experience, which has become a very important part of the dining experience, and two, making restaurants what they used to be, which used to be a special occasion when going out to a restaurant, you would go out once a week, and it wasn't the idea. It's like we're going to go out to eat 7 nights a week.
It's that, and it's also let's try another one. I broke my leg, or I'm recuperating from an operation, and I'm housebound for a week, and I don't want to call the local Chinese restaurant to have me deliver your soggy noodles, but I can find somebody on the web who is nearby me, who will prepare seven meals a week for me, each one of them different, and they'll have the quality of being home cooked.
And do you think, I mean, with all this competition, obviously it's so new and people are getting into it with no need to make a business out of it. Do you think that this will consolidate, that this will just continue to have little niches, that people will just be happy to make 30 meals a week for people? Or where do you maybe see this 5 years from now in a set hierarchy?
Well, it's a little chaotic at the moment. Chaos is good because good things come out of chaos. But I'm quite certain that 3/4 of the people who are cooking these meals at home do not have health department approved kitchens. So someday someone will crack down on this. But there is so many people who are nibbling at the edges of the food world, either startups or people trying to invade other people's markets to capture their customers, that there could be big major changes coming in the next 5 years.
But how do you even compete if you have a real restaurant?
It's tough, and it's getting tougher because you're no longer just competing with other restaurants. You're competing with convenience stores. You're competing with Google. You're competing with Apple. You're competing with Mary Jane down the road who's cooking dinner for friends. It's becoming more and more fragmented as more and more people get into the food business. The good thing about being in the food business is people have to eat. They don't have to go shopping.
No.
So more and more people who are looking to augment their sales, and when I say people, I mean department stores and retail shops and convenience stores and any other form of retail where people used to go out to do something and then eat along the way, are now trying to capture the people themselves rather than having them eat at restaurants.
And you touched on this last year, and you touched on it again this year about essentially restaurants being surrounded by wolves. It's grown even more so that you'll just find people who are almost convenience. You know, they want to go there, and people like Moleskin or high-quality brands that are beginning to add cafes that are not just your general cafe but actually have a high level of quality and food that essentially provides a two-in-one for people where they might, as opposed to go shopping and go out for lunch, they can have lunch while they're shopping.
That's quite true. 40 years ago or so, of course, nobody remembers this, but I'm older. 40 years ago or so, department stores threw out all their food operations because they felt that they were just taking up too much space and not terribly productive, and they were the old-fashioned tea rooms, and people didn't want to go to them anymore. The people who worked in the food department were not the same as the people who worked in the fashion departments. So the result of that was that they sent all the people out into the mall to go eat. And it took them 40 years to discover that once they sent them out into the mall, they didn't come back. So in the last 5 years, department stores have ramped up their food considerably. So that's one. The other, which is a phenomenon of the last few years, is and you see this in the headlines at least once a week, of the department stores in this country shutting down. Sears, J.C. Penney, Macy's is closing 100 and some odd stores this year.
Crazy.
And it goes on and on and on. Those are leaving big holes in shopping centers. So we're looking at shopping centers that are losing their anchors. And one of the ways that they're now trying to attract people is they're building big food halls in shopping centers to create a social experience. One of the things about food that's unique is that you can't have a social experience with food unless you're out. If you're sitting at home by yourself or with your wife or girlfriend and you order in, that's not a social experience. So if you want to experience people, you've got to go out. So you find shopping centers adding food in a big way. You're going to see more cinema chains adding real food. The big one here in New York is Alamo Draft House, which just opened here in Brooklyn, and they have several in other locations where you sit in the equivalent of a first-class airline seat. You get a menu, you order it, and food comes, and hey, guess what? It's not Cracker Jacks.
Well, you know what's interesting is Nighthawk Cinema did that in New York, and they were actually able to overturn an 80-year-old rule about serving alcohol in theaters in order to open up the doors for these other things. So they're also changing legislation and how people can experience going out for an evening.
That's correct.
But you do also kind of lose the magic of movie, dinner, drinks afterwards. You do it all at once, and then it's kind of just over.
Well, yeah. but, you know, not everybody has all the time in the world to go out and do drinks, movie, and then dinner, especially
sure.
during the week. Especially during the week. So this is a great way to get it all done at once.
One of the more elegant things that you put into the trend report is the idea of death by a thousand cuts. And maybe you can just touch on that a little bit about how these cafes can how these stores can introduce cafes, but you know, a Whole Foods can't introduce a store.
What's interesting to me is that Whole Foods, let's use Whole Foods. Whole Foods is partnering with restaurants all across the country to open up little cafes or stands or bars within the Whole Foods, the overall Whole Foods store. So you've got a 65,000 square foot Whole Foods store with 12 different places to eat. So it's now part restaurant and part food store. But if I've got a restaurant, and it doesn't matter whether it's a chain restaurant or whether it's my own personal place that I created and run and loved, I can't suddenly open up a Whole Foods department because it doesn't make any sense. Mm. So we find retailers doing interesting things with cafes. For example, if you're young and trendy and you take your notes on a moleskin pad because that's what you have to have, it's a shame if you just do it on a piece of, on the back of an envelope. If you're a moleskin customer and you're in Europe, you'll find some moleskins that have added cafes. Why do they do that? Number one, it's added money, but that's not the real reason. They're doing that because your likelihood of buying something from Moleskin in the way of paper goods more than once a month is rather slim. But the likelihood of your coming to a Moleskin cafe, if it's convenient and good, might be twice a week. So I've increased the frequency of people who are coming. And in addition to that, once they're there, I've got to get a gift from Mary. Let's get one here. So this kind of synergy feeds on itself, but you don't see a restaurant logically adding a Moleskin department.
No. Do you see these additions of cafes to these retail spots as an actual long-term solution or just a short-term extension of the inevitable demise of their success and existence?
I think it's a long-term trend in part because of what we said about 10 minutes ago, that the whole industry is in chaos and being fractured in lots of unpredictable ways. So I think more and more people are going to experiment with some form of attaching food to their basic business in order to get increased frequency from customers.
I guess my question to that is that they can add the restaurants. Does that mean people will come? I mean, most people may at a restaurant, but it might not be good enough to compete in the restaurant world.
Do you see
the same shakeout of where some will succeed and some will fail, or is it because of this like new combination they'll all do okay enough to have some sort of shelf life?
And to add on to that, you talk about Chobani opening up a branded store, Pepsi, whose restaurant I ate at. They're not necessarily good spots. I mean, they're also equally constrained by the fact that they have to use certain products, or there's an underlying type of mission that is not maybe necessarily giving the chef freedom. It's tied back to certain products. So do you think that that could also hem them in where other restaurants have a much more creative palate?
Well, I think you just took a sidetrack.
Yeah.
But you took a detour, and it's a good one. There are branded companies that are planting the flag for their brands that are restaurant related, like, for example, Kellogg's opening a cereal store in the middle of Times Square. Kellogg's is not going to make any money on that cereal store. Any more than Hershey's makes any money on its store in Times Square. The idea is to plant the flag where tourists see you and create enormous top-of-the-mind awareness. And more big brands are doing this. So it's another form of competition for restaurants.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to come back to continue talking food trends with Michael. This is a song from one of our favorite live performances, the band called Static Jax. We'll be right back here on Snacky Tunes.
Just in the fog of the weather, the dirt, and I got no place.
the first trend that you call out this year that I think is probably the most interesting and ties back into what we've already discussed is the falling food prices and how they are benefiting at-home cooks and killing restaurants. So let's take the track of why falling food prices are actually helping consumers, and then we can delve into why they're not so great for restaurants.
Well, we happen to be in a fairly long-term situation where the prices of basic commodities have been declining in this country. They aren't in other places in the world, but things like corn, beef, chicken, eggs, cheese have been declining all at once. So if you're a home cook, if you're feeding a family, this translates into lower prices at the supermarket. So it's clear that that's good for the consumer. The problem with restaurants is, compared to supermarkets where you go shopping for your food at home, the problem with restaurants is that they use a lot more labor than supermarkets do. They use a lot more labor per dollar of sales, and they use a lot more labor per square foot that they're paying rent on. So when the price of food falls, supermarkets can lower their prices and advertise that they're lowering their prices. But when those same commodities fall for restaurants, restaurants still have to deal with the cost of rising labor and rising rent, which these days is more important than whether the cost of food is going down. So restaurants are behind the eight ball because they can't raise their prices too much. Otherwise, they open up a big gap between what it costs to eat in the restaurant and what it costs to shop for food at home. And that gap has become evident to consumers, so that the number of people who are going to restaurants in the last 6 months has been declining.
Well, you talked about last year about the death or the abolition of tipping, which has actually led to higher restaurant prices. So there are certain restaurants that can absorb the higher prices that you touch on being in a bubble.
The restaurants that are fairly trendy, that are oriented towards young people who are making a lot of money, people in the techie world and the financial industry, and people who, like you and your brother, who are just rolling in money.
Oh, yeah.
Well, look, folks, hey, we're sitting here in Roberta's in Bushwick in
sure.
what used to be the middle of nowhere. And I know when I get through with this broadcast, I'm going to have to wait in line for a table unless you have some influence.
We'll take care of you.
We'll take care of you.
Those kinds of restaurants are doing rather well. The question is, how long can that keep up? ask Mr. Trump.
But
I guess my question is, what sort of mindset or what even sort of unique point of view do you even need these days to open a restaurant and be successful and have it last for 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
My late partner, Joe Baum, used to say that the definition of a classic restaurant was one that lasted the length of its lease. The failure rate in the restaurant industry is enormous. It takes a certain level of lunacy and dedication to open a restaurant and make it work, which is why most restaurants fail. The problem is that it used to be a very easy industry to get into because the failure rate was so high that you could always open a restaurant on the bones of a dead one. So you would buy a restaurant or take over a restaurant lease where space had failed and the air conditioning is there and the exhaust is there and the plumbing, and you just stick a new restaurant into it. And I think that a lot of this happened after the last economic collapse in 2008, when suddenly there was a huge supply of vacant restaurants and real estate values had plummeted, and so you could get a favorable lease and run a restaurant. What's happening today is that real estate values have gone up for the last 4 or 5 years, and landlords are taking advantage of that by doing what would be natural for them, to raise their rents. So it becomes economically more tenuous to open up a restaurant today.
There's the guys down in Houston who run Underbelly. Their new concept is a restaurant that is only for 5 years, which was the only amount of length that they could get for the lease. And I wonder if the idea of a restaurant existing forever, it's just no longer feasible. And maybe the idea is you're going to open up a restaurant for a couple of years, knowing that you're going to have to open up a new space after that. And do you see that as factoring into something where, like, food and restaurants, especially in department stores or Amazon or Uber, like the whole thing where they just know that they're going to be quickly changing their approach to their food and service, and that just becomes part of what it means to be in the food business now?
Well, partly. If I were concerned that the restaurant that I was thinking of would only last for 5 years, because then it would die just a natural death because of its life cycle, I would still want a 10 or a 15 year lease, because if that restaurant died, why wouldn't I want to take advantage of a good lease and put another restaurant in there? I think what you're referring to in Houston, and these are smart guys. They have looked at what it takes to make money in a five-year lease and amortize the cost of a restaurant and work backwards and says, okay, well, we can only spend $100 a square foot. Or if it's a 5,000-square-foot restaurant, we can only spend $500,000 on this place. If we can bring it in for that, at the end of 5 years, we can throw it away and know we made money.
I mean, it's really...
Doesn't that come into the idea of, like, pop-ups or things like that, where then the customer is also understanding that it's not going to be, you know, wood and china and, like, the highest-end crystals, because they know it's sort of temporary, and the customer understands it's sort of, like, fleeting nature?
You know, you've put your finger on something else. The idea of, you know, fine polished wood and crystal and fine china, they're pretty much gone. It has very little to do with whether it's a pop up or not, or how long the lease is. It has to do with the fact that we don't eat that way anymore, and we're spending the same prices in places where there's a really good chef who's turning out really good food, but the atmosphere is casual. It has none of the pretenses and none of the trappings of what used to be called quote-unquote fine dining.
I mean, you do also have, though, again, to go back to this bubble, the Cuckoo, the Stephen Starr restaurant that was just named New York Times Best Restaurant of the Year, which has a $200,000 a year line item on Candles and Linen and Rhone. So there are some small restaurants that do fall into that, but you do, I agree, see the rise of the fast casual, people who can get this high quality food and not have to have all the trappings that would get, you know, the 3-star or whatever reviews.
Well, you know, there's something about Cuckoo that splits the difference. It has fine china and it's got linens and it's got a lot of waiters walking around and busboys and captains and a serious wine list. And a lot of chandeliers. But if you look around at the rest of the place, there's not much in the way of expensive finishing. It's pretty bare bones with a lot of decor to take your mind off the fact that it's bare bones. A lot of carpenters didn't build a lot of millwork in that restaurant.
But isn't it nice to have, I mean, as far as design, I think back to Momofuku's sound bar. You know, you come in and there's arguably that one giant piece of artwork, and it's pretty bare bones, but the food is outstanding. And to me, it's like, I'd rather have one or two big statement pieces or chandeliers and pay more for the food than for, you know, high-end decor and paying off the plates and the napkins and things like that.
Oh, I agree. And by the way, the difference between the casual looking places and the fancy upscale looking places is translated into not just price, but it translates into a different kind of attitude of why you went there in the first place. And if you were going to some place that resembled an old-fashioned French restaurant, which Le Cuckoo is not, But if you were going to Shea something or other in Minneapolis or Detroit, it would have been a French restaurant with chandeliers. Would have had red flocked wallpaper. It would have had thick carpets on the floor. It would have had waiters in tuxedos, and it would have had a Frenchman standing at the door with his nose in the air. Those places are dead. There are very few left because of our attitude and their attitude. We don't like their attitude, and we want to be more casual in the way we, you know, we don't have to feel like we're sitting up in our chair. I can slouch and still have caviar.
One of the other things that's been in decline has been the consumption of meat. There's also been a really interesting rise in artisanal vegetable butchers, which you touch on, which is one of my favorite stories to emerge from 2016 and to arise and want to visit in 2017, especially in the Herbaceous Butcher in Minneapolis, which is starred on my Google Maps to go travel to. So can you touch on what these butchers are doing and how they still have the cleaver in hand, but how they're producing their and curating their vegetable selection?
That's a big trend, and you just touched on a little corner of it. The bigger trend is the focus on vegetables, and this has been building for a decade, but in the last year or so, it's suddenly become really important. There are a fair number of restaurants in this country that have put at least equal focus on vegetables as they have on protein. And there are some restaurants that are only serving vegetables, but also getting the same care that talent applied to them that you would have found in the French restaurant with the chandeliers. And they become very exciting places to eat. And you don't go there because I feel like I only want to eat vegetables tonight. I go there because the food's really good. They have a good wine list. The vibes are good. And it doesn't feel like a restaurant of 20 years ago that was health food, where you felt you were doing penance and that was going to make you feel healthier. So this is real cooking with real chefs and real food and real sauces, and you suddenly discover you're not even aware that you're missing the fish or the shrimp or the beef.
I still remember back to Darren and mine's 30th birthday. We went to Blue Hill Stone Barns, and the only dish I can really remember is the parsnip cake that they made for us as part of the, not even a dessert, as a main
course.
That's
the only dish you can remember?
That is the only dish that I can remember. So,
wow. Good thing we got a 12-course dinner.
Good thing we got a 12-course dinner. So to go back, and these butchers are not just making kind of mush and bowls or grain and bowls. They're actually trying to make things that look like ribs, patties, chicken, duck, etc.
Well, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
If you go to a restaurant like Nick's in New York or Veg in Pittsburgh, you will get vegetables that are cooked and still look like vegetables. They're not imitation anything. They're not pretending to be anything other than themselves in a great presentation with a lot of talent applied to them. And so you when you eat them, you don't get the sense that you're having false spare ribs. Or something made with tofu that's supposed to represent something else. The other side of this coin, and I'm coming back to your vegetarian butcher, there are a number of places around the world using the term vegetarian butcher who are fabricating out of tempeh and soy and gluten and other unmentionable things. Food that looks like spare ribs, looks like hamburgers, looks like bacon, looks like barbecued beef, but is made from plant matter. I suppose a rhetorical question is, if somebody really doesn't want to eat meat, why would they go out to shop for something that looks like spare ribs but isn't?
I think that people, and I remember this from one of my vegan friends who came to New York 9 years ago, and there was this place on Washington Square that he wanted to go to because it was all
Red Bamboo.
Red Bamboo.
Red Bamboo.
That really was all drumsticks and ribs and everything. This was 9 years ago, and he was so excited to get to try to get back. He didn't want to eat meat anymore, but he missed the texture. He missed eating wings. He missed eating chicken. So I think it depends on why you go vegetarian, that some people want to go for health reasons or for ethical reasons, but it doesn't mean that they didn't enjoy eating meat at the time. So I think you find somewhere in the middle of vegetables presented like vegetables, like you said at Nick's, but also sometimes people just want to have a rib, even if it's not coming from any type of animal.
Well, I was very sly. I said it was a rhetorical question.
And you touch on Beyond Meat as well, which promotes itself as the vegetable burger that bleeds, which is a really intense way to go about it. I don't even know if I eat my burgers and look for the blood running out of it, maybe juices, but to make something that goes so far to mimic dead animal blood is really an extreme way. But they've sold out. They've got investment from major food corporations, yes. And they see a market for that.
I mean, it seems like it's big business, you know.
There are two companies that are working on what we call burgers that bleed, and they're plant-based foods that are trying to be as close to the texture and flavor and look of meat as they can possibly be. And they're getting massive amounts of investment from Silicon Valley, I guess because there's no more money left in microchips. They're spending vast amounts of research and development dollars on these kinds of foods. What I find peculiar is... Did we lose somebody?
No.
Oh, what I find peculiar is that on the one hand, we see consumers really avid about getting what they call clean food or food with clean labels with no preservatives, no additives, no chemicals, nothing artificial, nothing that doesn't belong there. And you pick up a package and the ingredients should be as simple as it possibly could be. And then on the other hand, we have all this investment money going into these bleeding burgers, and I'm going to read you the ingredients of what people are flocking to. So there's one bleeding plant-based burger whose ingredients consist of pea protein isolate, expeller-pressed canola oil, refined coconut oil, water, yeast extract, maltodextrin, natural flavors, gum arabic, safflower oil, salt, succinic acid, acetic acid, non-GMO modified starch, cellulose from bamboo, methyl cellulose, potato starch, beet juice extract, ascorbic acid. I'm not done.
The point is taken.
I don't think when Dan Barber and Michael Pollan were saying eat less meat, eat more vegetables, that's exactly what they were thinking of. I don't think they were thinking of the highly processed fake meat.
I don't think they were either.
But one can argue that it's, again, I think this is the chaos that you were referencing earlier, where people are trying to find the right balance of how do they live a less impactful lifestyle while still kind of being healthy, and it's still, this is the other extreme of what you're discussing.
Yeah, and there's even a further extreme, and those are the people who are trying, and with some modest success, trying to build beef in the lab using cells from animals. So if you take the right cell from the right place in a cow and nurture it in a petri dish and whatever chemicals you need to do to make a cell grow, and this cell multiplies in the right way, it will give you meat. It will also give you leather. You can have a handbag, and you can have a hamburger without killing an animal.
And they made, the first one was something like $20,000 to eat. And I'm sure as the costs go down, people will be more and more intrigued to try something that's grown in that way that doesn't have, ethical questions arise, but different ethical questions than killing of a live animal.
Well, it's not even just killing live animals. It's all of the cow poop. And all of the methane that comes along with that, and it's all of the intensely raised chickens and pigs who pollute the water and the soil. It's all that fertilizer that doesn't have to be applied to the food that's fed to the cow. You know, it's really a very big deal if it works.
We're going to take one more musical break, and then we're going to come back and do our favorite part of this trend show, which is the buzzwords. This is a track from Wall, live on Snacky Tunes. We'll be right back.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sirchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sirchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sirchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Our favorite buzzword to come out for 2017 is drone delivery.
Oh, yeah.
We are going to be in New Zealand in February, and we are super excited to try to get a Domino drone delivery. But we would love for you to expand upon how this is happening, and has there been any reports back on if the food maintains its quality or it's more just the novelty of getting a drone to drop off something for you to eat?
Right now, it's largely a novelty, but the people in the drone business are not kidding around. Amazon has long been working on a system of delivering product to your home via drone because it's too expensive to have trucks tied up, burning gasoline and stuck in traffic, and making 50 or 60 different stops with a unionized driver who gets paid a lot of money plus benefits plus Social Security and 401ks. So, and by the way, some of these big companies are looking at drones as a way of just getting merchandise from point A to point B within their own warehouses. So I'm not sure it's worth going to the other end of the world to watch a piece of pizza being delivered by Amazon.
It might be.
But Amazon just delivered a package by drone of food somewhere in England. It was just 3 weeks ago.
They have two customers right now in that thing, and they're going to expand to a few dozen and then hopefully the world. They're also looking into floating air warehouses that drones will then depart from the sky already.
Well, why not?
Sure.
But, you know, it doesn't make any economic sense now. But, you know, the first all-electric car didn't make economic sense either.
Sure.
But, you know, Tesla's now churning them out, and they're really fun to drive. I'm not sure I want to live underneath a place where a lot of drones happen to come at the same time because it's dinner time.
Or a drone, like just Chinese takeout, just drops on your head. So next buzzword up is French dip sandwiches, which you say for some reason. However, one of our past guests not too long ago just opened up a new French dip sandwich called Maison Pickle, which I was at last week, and it was wonderful. So it was great to see that that is one of the trends on this list.
You know, I've been wanting to get there. And it is for no particular – there may be a reason why people are putting French dips back on the menu. I have no idea what the reason is. But I can tell you we're working on a diner in New York, a big diner. And we're putting three French dip sandwiches on, one of which is an interesting one. We're stealing a sandwich from the Mexican world called torta ahogado, which means a sandwich that's been drunken. Basically what you're getting is a whole bunch of Mexican ingredients in a baguette that comes in a bowl with a very fiery tomato-based chili sauce. And you dip the sandwich in the sauce, and then you eat the sandwich. It's going to be fun, but don't ask me why.
Yeah, I can't understand either. I mean, the sandwiches were also not cheap. It was high-end ingredients. I mean, the most expensive one had foie gras in it. It was $36, but it was fantastic.
Yeah, we're doing one which is the equivalent of a cheesesteak, except we're using prime rib. a real prime rib, not a faux one. But there's another buzzword which derives from the last commercial we just listened to, your cheese commercial, raclette. We're seeing and using, by the way, more and more raclette. It's popping up around the country.
I had a wonderful raclette dinner in Germany, which is a tradition around the holidays, and super fun as well, especially the grilled meat. And it's also a lot more control over your own dining experience.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about the use of the cheese rather than the traditional raclette dinner. It makes a very good hamburger.
Next up, Asian bakeries. Next up is Asian bakeries, which we have always been going to through our mother, who has dragged us to them in all the Chinatowns all over the country. Why do you think that these are going to be on the rise? They've always been there. What's changed?
They've always been there. One of the interesting cities to go to in this country is Atlanta, which I guess because of my migration reasons, Atlanta has a large number of Korean bakeries. But I think in general, Korean Asian bakeries are on the rise. They've always been there, but they're now adding things that you can pick up as a snack, and they're part American and they're part Asian, and they mix very well. So you can go into an Asian bakery and get a hot dog wrapped in a croissant, just to pick a basic example. And they're adding more and more savory stuff rather than just sweet stuff, and that's changing the nature of who goes in there and when you go in. So I think we're going to see more and more of them. You're also seeing Asian fast food places opening with Asian desserts and Asian coffee places and the bubble tea places that are also serving Asian pastries.
Another word on here you just have standing by itself is celery. What is innovating in the world of celery?
I have to tell you, you're not the first person to ask me that question. It was an entirely arbitrary inclusion, and that's why it's sitting there just by itself. I'm suddenly seeing celery used back in salads. I'm seeing celery used in places where crunch is needed. And I just have a sense that chefs are rediscovering something like celery, as they did a couple of years ago when they rediscovered radishes.
Are we going to see a deconstructed high-end ants on a log turning up restaurants?
No, you might see a deconstructed Waldorf salad.
Another vegetable that we see in there that we've also been a huge fan of is cauliflower, which seems to be popping up everywhere. The new Kismet opening up for the Matt Capper team in L.A. is leading with a couple of cauliflower dishes. Why is that vegetable on the rise?
It's a vegetable that has a fairly neutral flavor that you can do all kinds of things with. Somebody a few years ago started slicing cauliflower steaks out of a head of cauliflower and serving them as steak. I see cauliflower with all kinds of flavors now. If you go to an Indian restaurant, in the first courses, you're going to find some form of cauliflower with curried spices on them. If you go to a Chinese restaurant, you're going to find General Tso's cauliflower. It's because it's neutral. It's because it's probably more fun to eat than George Bush's broccoli, which he said he would never eat again in his life after he became president. And it's a vegetable.
Another thing on here is clean label cold cuts, which you touched on a little bit earlier as well.
When I was a kid, my mother avoided buying things like bologna and salami because they had all kinds of bad things in them, preservatives and chemicals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You now find more and more of the big and new small companies producing ham, bacon that are not cured, for example. There's no nitrites in them. The idea that I said before that people want cleaner and cleaner food is now being translated into what used to be bad for you snacks.
War on waste, pickling everything.
Well, the war on waste is starting to get to be a serious thing. Somewhere between a third and a half of the food that's grown or produced in this country gets thrown away because we're rich and profligate. And it gets thrown away in restaurants because they either make too much food or they put too much food on the plate and you can't eat it. It gets thrown away in your house because the sell-by date passed yesterday and you're afraid to eat it even though it's perfectly fine. Or you bought too much of something. And look, there are some people in this country, lots of them, who can't deal with leftovers. There's something in their mind that's socially wrong about serving the same food the next day. So it goes out. If you're in India, half the food that's produced goes to waste for completely different reasons. They don't have refrigeration in proper quantity. The roads are so bad that the trucks take twice as long to get the food to you. The storage is bad, and so you get a lot of vermin and insects in the food, and it spoils. So somewhere around the world, between a third and a half of the food is thrown away. If you work backwards and figure out how much farmland that translates into and how much fertilizer and how many trucks had to move things from point A to point B in order to get the food to you so it could be thrown away, you come to something that looks like an ecological disaster. And if you now look again 30 years from now or 20 years from now, what the population will be in 2050, and you say if we throw a third of the food away that we need to feed another, 10 billion people, that's a lot of stuff to throw away. And so there is a huge amount of attention on how we can become more efficient in what we grow and how we transport it and how we eat it. And it really is an ethical issue.
There's a great app that just came out, or it's been started in the UK, called Too Good to Go, where it connects restaurants who have extra food at the end of the day, and they do priced full meals for cheaper dollar amounts and allow people to come pick them up, which helps cut down on food waste. And it's being rolled out in Berlin and across the UK, and slowly moving into the States as well.
Yes, you're seeing more of that. I was looking the other day at the website of a food distributor here in New York called Baldor, and they have taken up a program that Baldor is a big distributor of fruits and vegetables here. They have a program now of zero waste. Nothing goes in the garbage. It may go to a compost heap somewhere, but it doesn't go in the garbage. It may go to all the bruised fruit, may go to people who are making juices, for example, if they can't sell it to a restaurant. So,
amazing.
So we're going to see more and more of that, and it's a good thing.
The last one we're going to wrap up on is a childhood food favorite of ours, newfangled, reinvented cottage cheese.
Love a good bowl of cottage cheese.
There are a couple of companies, one from Israel, there's one in California, and there's a third somewhere else, I just can't think of it at the moment, that are trying to resurrect cottage cheese in the same fashion that yogurt got resurrected. Yogurt was originally a food that you didn't like until they managed to add sweet and savory things to it and get the water out of it and talk to you about how good it is for you. Cottage cheese is a latecomer, but I think it has the same kind of legs that yogurt could. And I like it.
I mean, I like it too. Well, we want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
A grand lucky number seven. You can get
number seven.
You can get the trend report at baumwhiteman.com. That's BAUMWHITEMAN.com. You can read 2017 and all years past to see how Michael and his partner has done. Michael, anything you'd like to say? One last exciting thing that you're hopeful for that will resound with us in 2017.
Oh, God.
hot seat right now coming at the end.
Nah, may we all eat well and survive it.
Perfect. Well, thanks for joining us. We are excited to be back for a brand new season of Snacky Tunes. We will be back next week with the chef from Underbelly. And thanks for tuning in. See you next week.
Thank you.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.